Thank you, Paul. Well, my title is sort of broad because at the time when I was to decide, I didn't quite know what to talk about, so it's nice to have a flexible title. But I'm going to narrow it down. My co-author, by the way, is my PhD student, David Furman, who did the numerical calculations. I'm going to speak about two topics today, the nonlinear Bragg scattering from an undulating seabed and 3D instabilities of crescent waves. I'm going to study these two phenomena with a numerical model, which is basically a solution to the Euler equations. We call it a high-order Poissonesque formulation, but it's not a Poissonesque formulation in common sense. What we solve is the fully nonlinear free surface conditions, the kinematic bottom condition, and then we make a series expansion to the Laplace equation in terms of two velocity variables, the horizontal velocity vector and a vertical particle velocity at some expansion level. And this expansion level is chosen to be a slowly varying expansion level, which is approximately at mid-depth. Then we truncate the system. We truncate it so we leave fifth derivative operators in the system, and we introduce Padé-type operators to enhance the accuracy of the system. This method has been described in several papers quite recently, so I won't go into more detail. I'll just say that the achievements of the formulation is that we can treat fully nonlinear waves up to a wave number times water depth of 25. We can treat, if we are interested in vertical details like the velocity profile or the pressure profile, they would be accurate up to a kh of 12, also for fully nonlinear waves. And then recently we have extended it to be able to treat wave transformation over rapidly varying bathymetry. We can cope with bed slopes up to of the order 1. So much about the numerical model, and then I'll describe the phenomena we have studied. So the first phenomena is the Bragg scatter from a undulating seabed, and it's well known that the resonance condition for this case is the classical Phillips resonance condition for wave-wave interaction plus a number of steady wave numbers describing the steady seabed. So that's the general resonance condition for this Bragg scatter. It's floating around here. I'll go to the other side. Yeah. Too much wind, yeah. I didn't include that. That's right. So, the classical Bragg scatter, as we all know, is the class 1 Bragg scatter, which involves linear surface waves, and we have the classical resonance condition involving two surface wave numbers and the ripple wave number. And what we find is if we restrict the simulation to a single dimension, single horizontal dimension, we find the classical result that the scatter will lead to a reflection on half the ripple wave number, and the reflection will be of the same frequency as the incoming wave. And this has been studied extensively, experimentally, theoretically, and numerically by several authors. We have done this and verified the accuracy of the model. I won't show you results from this classical case. I'll concentrate on the more interesting case, which is the class 3 Bragg resonance, which was discussed and introduced recently by Yu and Liu in an excellent paper from 98, where they discuss it involves nonlinear surface waves. So in this case, we have three wave numbers and a single ripple number. And in the simplest case, we would account for the incoming incident wave twice. So we would get the resonance solution that the scattered wave will be 2 times K1 plus minus K. And we see that the scattered wave will occur at the double frequency of the incoming wave. Now we have two solutions. The minus would give us a scatter which is a reflected wave, the usual type of scatter, and the plus will lead to a wave, a scattered wave, which will run in the same direction as the incoming wave, meaning it's a reflected wave. A transmitted wave. Now, as a first attempt, we could apply linear dispersion relation to describe the frequencies omega 1 and omega 3. And if we do that and combine it with the resonance condition, we can iterate this system to determine K3 and K1 for given ripple wave number and given depth. And this is exactly what Lou and Yu did, and we're going to follow their test case. So we're going to consider the case of KH of 2.6, and that leads to two possible resonance solutions, one where K1 is approximately 2.22 times the ripple wave number, and that case leads to a Bragg reflection, and the other case where K1 over K is 0.6 approximately, that leads to a Bragg transmission. This is the numerical result. On the vertical axis, we have the reflection coefficient. On the horizontal axis, we have the incoming wave number divided by the ripple wave number. So we are expecting resonance to occur at 0.227 according to the linear dispersion relation. We immediately notice we made the simulation for three different incoming steepnesses, and we see that there's a downshift in the location of the resonance when the amplitude is increasing, and we also see that the amplitudes or the reflection coefficients are increasing. For small steepnesses, the reflection coefficient will increase linearly, corresponding to a quadratic interaction that is described theoretically in Lou and Yu. And their result is actually their numerical result using a HOS, a spectral method, is shown here. We see a reasonable agreement with our results, although there is a tendency to a phase shift. I cannot. Yeah. In fact, not. We have taken care of the fact that we're actually generating the incoming wave with stream function theory. So we are taking into account that H1 is not necessarily 2 times A1. So, approximately, yeah. At least for smaller waves. So one remaining question, which was actually not answered by Lou and Yu, was why do we get the downshift? I'm going to return to that question. Before we discuss that question, we have the other result for the transmitted case. So again, this time we have four different incoming steepnesses. And again, we see that the coefficients increase initially linearly with increase in incoming steepness. But when the waves become steeper, the increase tends to trade off. Again, we see a strong change in the theoretical location of the Bragg. In this case, we see an upshift of the location. So we have two remaining questions. Why do we get downshift for reflection? Why do we get upshift for transmission? To answer this question, we have to go to a third-order dispersion relation for bichromatic wave trains. And looking in the literature, I was able to find four references. Yeah. Longer, Higgins and Phillips from 62, Hogan and Chiasny from 88, Pearson 93, Tsang and Chen from 99. They had an expression like this. Unfortunately, all of these papers are dealing with deep water conditions only. And for the Bragg scatter, we need an intermediate depth formulation. just to explain briefly what this tells you, you have the frequency expressed in terms of the classical linear dispersion term. Then we have the self-self interaction term, which is the classical Stokes third order theory for monochromatic waves. And then we have a new correction term here, which takes into account the effect from the interacting wave. So we have this transfer function, which would be a function of both wave numbers, K1 and K3. So this is really the function we're interested in. Now, deriving that on an arbitrary depth and comparing it to, for instance, the solution by Tsang in infinite depth gives you this result, which may be somewhat surprising. We have K1H on one axis, K3H on the other axis, and you would expect a deep water formulation to be valid in deep water. In fact, it's not. If you draw the square here, it's KH of 3, you'd see that you have a lot of percentage error also outside the region of shallow water. In shallow water, you get something like 20% error. Out here, 10% and 5%. Well, the reason is that when you work it out, this transfer function becomes a function of the second order transfer function to sub and superharmonics. Obviously, you can make a deep water approximation to the superharmonic transfer, but if you do that for the subharmonic, you would make errors always if the two wave numbers are nearby, no matter how deep the conditions are. So we have some discrepancy there. But anyway, when we go back and insert the third order dispersion relation in the resonance conditions, we can again iterate. Now we can get K3 and K1 for given A1 and A3 and K and H. So, yeah? Yeah? Yes. No. There are only these two types. Okay. Yeah. I think this agrees with your paper, actually. You have the same form. But we can check that up later, maybe. Anyway, so now I can get a new estimate for K1 and K3. And when I draw that up, I get this curve here. So the vertical axis is now the corrected incoming wave number, which is supposed to lead to resonance. And it's divided by the wave number we had before, according to linear theory. So we can immediately see that if we concentrate on the reflection solution, the solution tends to dip down here. So that's clearly explaining the downshift for reflection. And for transmission, we clearly get a trend for an upshift. So the trend is correct. Now, these curves will depend on the ratio of A3 to A1. So I plotted just two numbers here, one where it's 0.5, which is typically a typical reflection coefficient or transmission coefficient, and one where it's 0. Two curves for each, and we would expect our numerical experiments to fall somewhere in between these two lines. Then when we plot the reflection, it falls on the higher curve, on the 0.5 curve, which is probably not surprising because our reflection coefficients were in the ball game of 0.3 and 0.5, so they should be somewhere up here. At the first instant, it might be more surprising that the transmission curves lie almost perfectly on the 0 line. But there's, of course, an obvious explanation if you think of it. When the scatter is a transmitted wave, it will never go back and affect the incoming wave from the ripple path to the wave maker. So the mechanism of Bragg will actually not be influenced by the amplitude of the scattered wave, but only of the amplitude of the incoming wave. So that's why the transmission curve would tend to fall on the zero line. That brings me to my next topic, which is the 3D instability, first observed by Su in the early 80s, also called the class 2 instability by MacLean, where a high unidirectional Stokes wave would, or not even Stokes wave, a high uniform unidirectional wave train would eventually evolve three-dimensional instabilities, and the most typical one is the one which repeats itself every second wavelength, the so-called L2 crescent. So this is a nice photograph taken by Su. Now this phenomenon is known to be a quintet interaction phenomena, and we take the carrier wave, that means a very high incoming wave, unidirectional wave, we take that into account three times and add two perturbations which are oblique. And in the model we do this by using stream function theory to generate the carrier wave at some frequency, and then we add two perturbations, and these perturbations should have an x component and a y component of the wave number. If we use periodic boundary conditions, this would be sufficient to describe the initial condition by this. But actually, the model is not using periodic condition; it's using a wave maker condition, and then an absorbing boundary layer, an absorbing layer at the very far end of the model. So we need to describe this phenomena by its frequency at the wave maker. So we are faced with the problem of relating omega 1 to k 1 and omega 2 to k 2. The first attempt would be again linear deep water theory, but we've already seen that that doesn't work well for the Bragg, and we could actually use the same third order theory to determine omegas from these k's, and in that case we would see that a very good approximation could be obtained, which if we assumed perturbations to be of zero amplitude, but still the high amplitude of the carrier wave would influence their frequencies significantly, between 15 or 20% increase according to linear, relative to linear theory. Now another way of determining the relationship between wave numbers and frequencies is actually embedded in MacLean's nonlinear stability analysis. So that's a more direct way of getting the information. To do that, we need to transfer the perturbations from the fixed Eulerian frame to a moving frame, a frame moving with the carrier wave. So that would transform the phase function to this form, where omega star would have this relation between omega 1 and k1x, and the similar form for the other perturbation. Now, the perturbation could be written in this fashion, and that's exactly the form of the perturbation given in MacLean's work. And then determining the eigenvalue problem would determine the values of omega star. If it has a imaginary contribution, we would have instability. The magnitude of it would give the strength or the rate of growth of the instability. And if it has a real part, that real part could be directly related to what I wrote in the frame here. So the real part would tell us whether this oscillation, this perturbation is going to oscillate or not. So actually, the question about will this instability oscillate in time, or will it be stationary in time, all the information is embedded in MacLean's analysis. So what we do is we use the MacLean analysis, we determine the omega r, we relate it to this formula, and determine omega 1. These are a list of experiments we did. So first we considered the classical L2 problem on the first line here for steepness of 0.1 approximately, and with perturbation wave numbers of 1.5 times the carrier wave number. Just to emphasize again that linear theory doesn't work. If we use linear theory, it gives the frequencies of 1.33. Using MacLean analysis, we get 1.5. So a considerable increase. And with these 1.5s, we get exactly a steady situation, quasi steady, because it's probably more correct to say it's phase locked to the carrier wave. But eventually, the phenomena is going to steepen and reach a stage of breaking. So it's not steady in that sense. But we also see that when we compute the other phenomena observed by SU, for instance, the phenomena repeating itself every 3 wavelengths or 4 wavelengths, we find that these are going to be oscillating. The L3 is going to oscillate with 9 times the carrier period, L4 with 6 times the carrier period. And if we do the case which was observed by Collard and Collier, the latter one here, the L pattern, we find a oscillation period of 3.1, which is very close to what Collard and Collier observed. So let's have a look at the computational results. First, we have a close-up of the L2 pattern. I don't know if you can sharpen it a little bit. Maybe not. Okay. Anyway, so you see the generator is more or less here. So within very few wavelengths, the perturbation rises and gives a clear L2 shape where we have a low, high, low pattern repeating itself every second wavelength. This is just a snapshot. If we make another snapshot, follow the crest, we would see that it stays more or less the same. It may sharpen a little bit. Here's a close-up. See that it sharpens, but it's clear that the perturbation always stays phase-locked to the carrier. In contrast to this experiment, where we have simulated or seeded a perturbation which leads to an L4 pattern. We see here we have the high, high, low, low pattern repeating itself for every fourth wavelength. And if we follow a particular crest and look at 3 different snapshots, we can see that it goes from a low, this is also a low but slightly changed, and then to a high pattern. So this is clearly not stationary in time. And numerically, we can see that the period may not be exactly what we predicted, but the oscillation period is in the ball game of 6 times the carrier period.
What do you mean by low and high?
Yeah, okay. If you take the middle line here, the highest elevation would be when you have this arc here, while if you go to the next picture, you have a slightly decrease in elevation here. That's what I mean by it. Thank you. So we did the L pattern, and here the oscillation, the L pattern observed by Collard and Collier, and here the oscillation is very clear. First, we have that all the crescents are aligned. They are looking pretty much the same down the canal here. If we look at the snapshot a little bit later, they're still aligned, but now they are completely shifted. So from low, low patterns, it's high, high patterns. And then again, we get back to the low pattern. And this is covering more or less 3 times the carrier period in good agreement with what was observed by Collier and also what was predicted using the MacLean analysis. So I guess I have just time to show, I can show a last picture here where we have tried to play a little bit with competing class 1 and class 2 instabilities. So we are computing, we are seeding both types of instabilities at the WaveMaker. We are doing it for 3 different simulations, 3 different incoming wave steepnesses. In this case, the wave steepness is in the regime where we would expect the Benjamin sphere to dominate. And we do see that a 3D pattern doesn't really evolve, but we do get steepening down here, indicating a Benjamin sphere type steepening. When we go to 0.095, we have a little bit of both. We have certainly some crescents evolving, but we can also see that the magnitude of the crescents, they're sort of magnitude, they are amplified by the Benjamin sphere focusing. And then finally, when we go to 0.11, the Benjamin sphere is almost absent. It looks more or less like the other pictures I showed you, where you have just L2 crescent patterns. So let me come to the conclusion. We have studied two phenomena, class 3 backscatter, backscatter, where the reflection and transmission will occur at the double frequency. We've been able to explain that we would have a downshift and upshift of reflection transmission by using third order amplitude dispersion in bichromatic waves. Then we've studied crescent waves. We have simulated the L2 pattern of SU and also confirmed that they are indeed steady and phase-locked. We've simulated L3. I didn't show you, but you have to believe me there. And L4 patterns, and they certainly turn out to be oscillating patterns. And then we also simulated the oscillating pattern of Collard and Collier's and explained the period which they observed using MacLean's analysis. Thank you for your attention.